Yeah, and I guess I was saying that maybe it was because it was a small unit here.
Yeah, well, he was chairman here, and they weren't, all the people in the department weren't the easiest ones to deal with, and of course, he had Steenbach and Link to deal with, and they were not easy characters to handle.
Did he have to actually intervene between them?
Well, I don't know that there was, I mean, there were, they would automatically get on opposite sides of the fence on an issue.
You're talking about department meetings, I suppose.
Yeah, that sort of thing, and so there were some problems there, but Connie always carried it off very well and kept things under control. And likewise, I never really heard any complaints about him running the graduate school. He did that while he was actually chairman of the department. Well, when he became president, obviously, he had a full-time job, and so he always appeared around biochem, but he had to drop most of his work. And you just can't run the presidency and run a research organization on the side very effectively. But he was a remarkably productive person, and I thought he was a very good administrator. Never had any problem with it. The thing that destroyed Connie was dealing with the med school. up until the problems in the medical school, he had dealt with, by and large, with rational people on the campus. And he made a decision, and there was a democratic decision by some kind of a council or a departmental action, and he made it stick. But when he dealt with a med school, you'd make a decision, and immediately these guys would go back and it'd unravel.
Yeah.
He was not dealing with rational people. He was dealing with MDs. And MDs are a law unto themselves. Mostly PhDs are willing to discuss an issue and come to a decision on it and then back the majority decision. But with the medical school, he found that they would sit down, they'd discuss the issues, they'd come to a decision, and I think things were fixed up. They'd go back and they'd open the whole issue up again and rehash it. That wasn't the way he was used to dealing with people, and it really killed the person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody can deal with these people. And I don't think one should say that Connie wasn't a good administrator just because he couldn't deal with a bunch of MDs. I think that that the honor should be on the MDs, not on Connie.
You are specifically talking about the surgery department.
Well,
there were others, too?
Well, I know quite a few rational MDs, too. And some of them are good friends of mine. But by and large, with the people over in surgery, of course, it was these guys are a bunch of prima donnas.
Mm.
And
well, he was a friend of Carreri's, and apparently Carreri had a link with biochemistry because he tested things for you.
Well, Carreri checked some things, you know, but and Tony had his finger in lots of things around the campus. Tony was a very outgoing person. Everybody on the campus knew him because of his career as a boxer here, as a student, and all that sort of thing. So Tony was and he was very active, of course, in the World War II group, medical group from the campus.
Mm.
Tony was known to all the legislators and all this sort of thing. So he was well known, and he did do some testing. But
I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is one of the things you do. Somebody brings a compound over and you test it, so what?
Part of the work. One of the criticisms of the medical school is that it wasn't available to test findings made in the sciences, so...
Well, let's face it, in those days we did not have a very distinguished medical school. It's better now, but it has never been in the top rank among medical schools, and one has to recognize that. It's not one of the old medical schools in the country. Of relatively recent in origin as med schools go, and although there's some very good people in the med school, it's never overall been a really distinguished
mm-hmm.
department.
Yeah.
And when you're dealing with surgeons, you're dealing with a difficult bunch of prima donnas.
Mm.
I mean, these guys go into the operating room and they're God. Everybody kowtows to them, and they think the rest of the world should look at them that way. Just because the nurses have to kowtow to them doesn't mean that everybody else in the world has to operate that way. This is the kind of people he's dealing with, and I think it is distressing because Connie had always been very successful as an administrator until he had to deal with these MDs.
Well, his health wasn't very good either, then, I guess.
Well, Connie was never a health bug. You know, he never, as far as I know, never exercised. He led a very organized and balanced life and didn't abuse himself. But on the other hand, he never exercised to keep in shape or anything like that. So he may have neglected his health somewhat. But, you know, after all that heart attack and cerebral hemorrhage, that sort of thing can hit anybody at any time.
Yeah. You said that he didn't get the cream of the crop of graduate students, but usually don't graduate students apply to work with someone? Why didn't he have good people applying?
Well, actually it becomes very complicated about assignment of graduate students. It's much more formalized now than it used to be. We now, in the department, with the students that come in, we rotate them through the labs, and then they make a choice, and we try to meet their first choice, but that doesn't always happen. Some of them have to be assigned. Now, back in the so-called good old days, it was much less formal than that. The departments had less departmental funds for hiring the students, and many of the students came in on the basis of direct offers from their major professor.
That's what I had thought.
Yeah, say over the credentials and I have some funds and I write a kid and say, would you like to work in my laboratory? Mm. And so he says yes, and so he comes and he goes in my lab and that's it. But now they like to agonize about it and figure, well, I'd like to rotate through the laboratories and take my time making a great decision, all this sort of thing. And but in those days, there would be a certain number of students who would come in, and they'd be unassigned. Mm-hmm. And if their record was not that spectacular, people might drag their feet about picking them up. And Connie often got those people because he was chairman, and so he had to take care of them. Hart didn't ever have as big a research show as Connie did. Mm. Hart had students, and they all had good students. We've had good students here, We've had good students, but there's a difference in them. And at that time, my feeling was that Connie sometimes got stuck with the stragglers because he was chairman and he had to take care of them, so he'd pick them up. Doesn't mean that he didn't have some good students. He had a fairly good-sized group, and he often had some very good students because he was an attractive person to work with. And after all, he had an excellent reputation in his area, and he was a nice guy to deal with, and so people were attracted to him. The students are not... the students go around and talk to each other, and they find out where the difficulties are in the department.
Yeah.
And so they... this influences them, and there was nothing... negative about Connie. He was really a very fine person to work with.
Do you think he would have gotten the Nobel Prize if he'd stayed on in research?
This is strictly speculation because, there aren't very many Nobel Prizes, and there are a lot of winners in various areas. And I'm sure his name was proposed, and. Whether he would have gotten it is questionable because there are a lot of people who deserve it who haven't gotten it. I would say one of the outstanding examples is David Kalin, with whom I worked at Cambridge. Kalin really did spectacular work, in my opinion, really important in biochemistry. And Kalin never got it. And part of it is because Warburg got there first, and Warburg and Kalin never saw eye to eye, and the ex Nobel Prize winners. Nobel Prize winners have a rather strong influence, and some of the Scandinavians who were influential on the committee had been in Warburg's laboratory, so this sort of militated against Kalin. And although his work was really monumental in biochemistry,
how do you spell it?
Kalin, K-E-I-L-I-N.
Uh-huh.
David Kaler. But he's, I mean, there are lots of other examples, but you, to speculate about whether somebody's getting a Nobel Prize is...
Okay, is, a couple of people have speculated, and I was curious
pie in the sky,
about your opinion.
Yeah, these are, I mean, some of them are obvious things, but a lot of them are, I mean, it could go one way or another. Mm. So.
What was anything very dramatic happening in biochemistry in the 40s? I know there was new equipment coming in. That would be one thing, is that right? But developments that would require you to get new kinds of new faculty specialists?
Well, there were certain developments during that era. I would say the thing that developed in the 40s that had more influence on forming biochemistry or anything else was the introduction of radioactive isopes, and to a certain extent stable isopes, although they had less impact.
And that's something you were involved in.
Well, yeah, I was. I'd worked with stable isotopes, which are a little bit more difficult to work with than radioisotopes. You have to use a mass spectrometer for the detection of most of them. This involves more instrumentation than radioisotopes. And the radioisotopes, you can operate in greater dilution, this sort of thing. So they have a lot of advantages. Well, I was interested in isotopes, and so in 1946, I spent the summer at the Argonne Laboratory, which to learn radioisotope techniques.
Did you get a fellowship to do that?
Or? No, I just went down there and spent the summer. Arranged with a dean so I could go down there and just stay on the payroll here. But the Argonne Lab, of course, was one of the early radioisotope labs. This was, after all, an offshoot from the Fermi's first nuclear reactor on the Chicago campus. And then they had built it up as one of the major laboratories during World War II for the development of the atomic energy. So much of the pioneering work on the separation of isotopes, radioisotopes, was done at the Argonne National Laboratory, so-called. So I went down there, learned the technique, spent the summer, then came back, and we used radioisotopes from then on, as well as stable isotopes. And it wasn't until 46 that you could really get these. You see, if you had a cyclotron, you could generate radioisotopes. But if you didn't have access to a high-energy accelerator, it was pretty tough. Now, Ray Herb, of course, had an accelerator in physics, but it was not used very much for production of isotopes. It was, to a certain extent. But the centers of activity were places like Berkeley, where they had big cyclotrons and such, and they were turning out radioisotopes. But the general public was not able to buy these until August 1946, when the Atomic Energy Commission released them. And you see, the most popular isotope with the biochemist has been carbon-14, because this, most everything a biochemist deals with is a carbon compound. So you can label it with carbon-14. It has a half-life of 5,700 years, so you can do your measurements very leisurely, in contrast to the radioactive isotope carbon-11, which has a 20.5-minute half-life, and you have to work pretty rapidly with that. But the carbon-14 was a real addition to the tools of the biochemist.
What I'd like to know is, did the other people like Link and Steenbach, was this something of interest to them, or Peterson or Phillips?
Rather casually, I don't remember that Connie used C-14 or Link or Steenbach. Well, no, Steenbach did. Steenbach used radioisotopes fairly early in the game, and so he did. He had a Geiger counter, and he used them fairly early. Henry Lardy embraced them quickly. Henry and I did a little bit of work together on radioisotopes. And within a few years, it was in most of the laboratories. But most of these fellows didn't embrace it very quickly, except for Steenbach. And Steenbach was a great guy for instrumentation. New instrument come out, Harry would usually get it.
Because he could afford it.
He could afford it, and he also was interested in instrumentation. Mm. And anything that new, he would look it over and try to see.
Was he able to understand
the
new equipment?
Oh, sure. I mean,
I mean, that must be a problem.
Well, I mean, these instruments aren't all that complicated. Oh. I mean, back in the good old days then, when I started using radioisotopes, we made our own Geiger tubes and this sort of thing. So you had to start from scratch. Mm. And back a few years before that, friends of mine like Harlan Wood were making this, concentrating their own stable isotopes. You couldn't even get carbon 13, that's a stable isotope tracer. So he used to make this stuff. Mm. And back in that era, instead of buying a mass spectrometer, we had to make the mass spec. And as I said last time, Wallen over in physics helped us make a couple of mass spectrometers. So it wasn't just a matter of having some dollars and going out and buying them. Some of these instruments were not commercially available. We got one of the first commercially available mass spectrometers in 1949. Mm. Tom Brittingham got interested in Consolidated Engineering Company, which was producing mass spectrometers, and he volunteered to buy one for us. So we got one from through the Brittingham group. Yeah, it was in 1949, and it cost $14,000, which was quite a bit then.
So that was for the whole department?
Well, everybody wanted to use it, they could. I mean, it was always open.
But it wasn't in anybody's lab.
Well, it was in my lab, but I mean, it was always open for anybody that wanted to use it. The last one that we bought cost us $100,000, and now it's $160,000 for the same instrument. Yeah. So they've gone up somewhat in price, and somewhat in sophistication. But the old 1949 one is still operating. Mm-hmm. It was a well-engineered instrument. So these... I would say that the isotopes really had a tremendous impact on it. And there were a lot of other methods. Actually, people probably now don't recognize how primitive spectrophotometric methods were back then. I can remember seeing the first DU spectrophotometer, this is a Beckman spectrophotometer, about 1939, I guess, down at the University of Chicago. And then there were... Of course, much later than this, there were developments in NMR and EPR spectrometry and such, which have had a great deal of impact. But in the 40s and 50s, I'd say the thing that really had the big impact was visual and UV spectrophotometry and use of isotopes as tracers.
Mm-hmm. So, and it would be important for people to get up on these and learn how to use them.
Oh, yeah. As I pointed out, Bill Huckster and I taught a course in isotopes, and we had six sections with 24 people in each, and every semester we'd get it subscribed up to 96 and have to turn them away.
Yeah.
So there was obviously a great deal of interest. It was a technique with obvious advantages, so we could see that.
So aside from the controversy between Link and Steenbach, on the whole, in the 40s, you were getting enough money for equipment and would you say that?
Well, it depends upon the standards of the time. When I came down on the staff in 1944, Hart told me I had $200 to run my laboratory for the year. Well, $200 doesn't go very far, I can assure you. Even in those days, $200 was not a lot of money. So money was extremely scarce, as a matter of fact. But our needs were modest. And okay, we needed a mass spectrometer. Today we have to go out and dig up $160,000 to buy one. Then there was no opportunity for that. Nobody had $160,000. So we went over to physics and scrounged a couple of vacuum pumps and this sort of thing, and some batteries, and got the fellows in the shop to build one. And it didn't cost us very much. The shop time, Wallen arranged for the shop time and such, and so we got by very inexpensively. And nitrogen 15, I bummed some off Harold Urey. He was the only person who had any N15 then, although Eastman Kodak had taken over some of his equipment, and Eastman Kodak was concentrating N15. So I had some that we bummed off Harold Urey for that sort of thing. You couldn't buy the radioisotopes until 1946, and then they were fairly costly then. You could buy small quantities of carbon-14. I think the individual could get 0.2 millicurie was the amount that you could get, and it was something like $360 a military.
Well, where'd you get the money for that?
Well, I can't really remember, but I remember early...
Did it change when Elvium became chairman?
I never got really very much money out of the department. I tried to find... In the federal granting agencies were very few and far between in those days. NIH didn't amount to anything. NSF hadn't been born.
Mm-hmm.
But there was the Office of Naval Research.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get an Office of Naval Research grant, and that was mm-hmm. one of the earliest ones. And the amounts were modest, but it also gave you access to surplus equipment
mm-hmm.
that the ONR kept the list, and you could ask for equipment that was surplus, and they'd give it to you. So that was helpful. That stretched the
funding. Was that something... How did you go about it, or how did you hear about it? The availability of the grant, and is that something that stands out in your memory as a
no,
first
that's,
grant?
No, that's too many years ago. That's and I don't remember what it was. I mean, it's one of these things everybody knows now about NIH, NSF, USDA, competitive grants, and that
the
sort of thing. So we knew
yeah.
about that Office of Naval Research existed and were a possible source of grants.
The reason I ask is that Harrington listed as one of the reasons for his successes in the life sciences was the ability to get federal grants, and the fact that people like Fred and Baldwin were known at the national level, so that and Laird, Melvin Laird, was working for the university.
Yeah, well, you see, Harrington and this sort of thing came later.
Yeah,
I mean, in
well,
the 40s, there really weren't much of any sources.
Yes, it's in the 50s he would be.
Yeah,
he
in
was,
the 50s, that's the picture starts to open up
uh-huh.
then, but. In the 40s, the money was scarce. Now, the other money that I got early on was from Red Dot Potato Chips.
Oh.
Now, in Madison, Red Dot Potato Chips was started in Madison by an MD and a couple of other entrepreneurs who started on a very small scale and built up a good size firm, mm-hmm. turning out good potato chips. And they had a problem with potato chips, namely that the big cost of potato chips is the oil, not the potatoes. And along towards spring, they take up more and more oil. So the potato chips may be as high as 40% of the weight as oil.
Yeah.
And you pay a lot more for a pound of oil than you do for a pound of potatoes. So they were concerned about this. Also, when you get too much oil, it bleeds into oil out into the sack and becomes very undesirable. And so they were concerned about that, and they gave us some money to look at potato chips. So I had a grad student named Bob Stutz, who had been released from the Navy because he had TB. And so he came here with the residues of TB and saw Dr. Dickey routinely over at the hospital. She just retired this year. And so Bob Stutz worked on potato chips.
Mm-hmm.
And we solved the problem for Red Dot by the simple expedient of preheating the potato chips in a salt solution.
Oh.
Well, this gave an absolutely uniformly salted chip, which was not something that was on the market at that time, and it reduced the oil uptake, and it also helped with the other problem, that is getting too brown a chip. In the spring, the chips get more sugar in them, and this browns on cooking, and that's undesirable. So we solved the problem of the oil uptake and the color of the chip and uniform salting.
Mm, all at one
and it was
swoop.
All at one fell swoop. It was a marvelous solution except for one thing. The chips came out flat. And they didn't bulk up in the bag.
Yeah.
And the person who buys potato chips buys this nice big bag of crinkly potato chips that bulk up. It looks like you're getting a lot. And you can't sell flat potato chips. Subsequently, of course, they have made these flat ones that are synthetic, and they
yes,
put them
yeah.
in a can. But no, nothing to do. We went to Wharf with this, and Wharf said it isn't patentable. Forget it. Frito-Lay bought Red Dot here some years ago, and Frito-Lay is one of the big food manufacturers in the country. About a month ago, in the Wall Street Journal, there was a big article about Frito-Lay. And Frito-Lay is now pre-treating a chip with a saline solution, a salt solution. And they figure they might have $100 million a year market for this product.
Wharf didn't want the patent on it. They said this wasn't patentable, and they're using exactly the same process apparently. And so this is one of those things that's sort of an interesting side. I'm probably happy I wasn't in on the commercial development. But anyway, that's where we got some of our early money.
I see.
And incidentally, the chips were accepted by our taste panels. They liked the chips. They were hard. They have a harder surface, but they liked the chips. And Bob Stutz was one of the more popular grad students because every time he went out to Red Dot, he came back with a big box of fresh, warm chips off the end of the line. And fresh, warm chips are really great. Yeah. So he was very popular. But this is the way we scrounged some money to work. I mean, there were very few sources.
Yeah. But what about Wharf? I mean, I've heard that Elvium could get pretty much anything from Wharf if he wanted it.
I don't remember really. Maybe I got some funding from Wharf. I probably did. I don't really remember. Actually, the National Science Foundation was started in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on one of the panels in 1950 at the NSS, so I knew pretty much the workings at that time. And it's sort of an interesting panel. On that panel, it was run by a fellow named, two fellows, Lou Levin and Consolazio, who had come from the Office of Naval Research and were experienced. They picked them up at NSF when they started it. And Lou Levin subsequently became the deputy of the NSF when Bill McElroy was the head of NSF.
Yeah.
And on that panel was Bill McElroy, who subsequently became the chief, and the executive officer was Lou Levin, who subsequently became his second in command at the NSF. And Fritz Lippmann was on that panel, later a Nobel laureate, and Gonzales was on that panel.
This would be written somewhere, wouldn't it?
I doubt it. That is sort of an interesting panel because of the subsequent.
How did you get on it?
I don't know. Somebody just suggested my name, I suppose.
Hmm.
So I don't know. But anyway, it was an interesting panel. And what makes me think about the difference in the scale of funding at that time is I recollect very clearly an application from Arthur Kornberg, the Nobel laureate from Stanford, in which Kornberg was asking us for $9,500 to do his research for the year at NSF. And we deliberated, should we give Art $9,500 he was asking for, or give him $8,500. Cut off $1,000. Well, you know, Kornberg, nah. Well, $8,500 won't pay for one grad student anymore.
Yeah, I can see that. That's
so. It was sort of an interesting panel, and the scale of granting then was quite different from the scale of granting now. In year one, 1950, of the National Science Foundation, they had either $3.5 or $4.5 million total.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if it was $3.5 or $4.5. It was either $3.5 or $4.5 million total for all sciences for the whole country. The current budget of NSF is over $1 billion.
Yeah.
So there is roughly a 300-fold increase in the funding of the National Science Foundation between then and now. And this sort of reflects a lot of things in funding. And NIH, you know, now is, $3.5 billion or something like that, I'm not sure. But anyway, it didn't really amount to very much then. There were certain other sources, such as the old growth. There was a panel on growth, I guess they called it. And this was largely funds from cancer research and that sort of thing that were assigned. Mm-hmm. And we used to go to Washington to dispense these funds. And that was before the NSF. But then NIH and NSF took over, and so they became the dominant granting agencies.
I'd like to hear your story about on the Enzyme Institute.
Well, the Enzyme Institute sort of originated as an idea with a respiratory enzyme seminar that had been going on here on the campus since the late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a grad student, I was actually routinely attended this seminar group.
Elvium.
Connie Elvium was very instrumental in it. I was going to try to drag down the copy of the book that came out, but in the early 1940s, the seminar group decided they'd put out a book on respiratory enzymes. And so it was a collaborative thing. Members of the seminar would each write a chapter. And it was edited, actually, by Connie Elvium and Perry Wilson.
Oh, yes.
Perry was an excellent writer. He wrote with great facility. He was subsequently an editor of Bacteriological Reviews. He wrote very nicely. And Perry and Connie Elvium edited this volume, and we all contributed chapters to it. Henry Lardy was part of it, and Phil Cohen, and Van Potter, and Marv Johnson, and Carl Bauman, and others. But there were a lot of the people who were interested in respiration were members of this, and so this continued for some time, and there was an interest in perhaps starting in some institute, but the two people who were really functional in making it go were Connie Elvium and Van Potter, as far as the institute is concerned. And there are a number of things around the campus where Van has had a finger in it. I'm very grateful to Van because he was very helpful to me at a couple of stages in my career. And so he was the kind of guy who'd get an idea and then he'd carry it through. And so Connie was very supportive of it. Van had worked with Connie as a grad student. So they thought maybe they should start it out and get an institute where some of this modern enzymology could really be practiced. So Van was attracted by the work at that time of Dave Green. Dave, of course, was a U.S. citizen, but he had spent his graduate days at Cambridge in England and was strongly influenced by the Cambridge School, which was a first-rate school of biochemistry at that time. Mm. So Dave Green had been there, and then he had gone to College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia, and he'd done a lot of research there. Very prominent research in the day, and he'd done some innovative things. He didn't have many grad students. As far as I know, the only grad student he has was Paul Stumpf, who was a plant biochemist at University of California, Davis. But Green had an active group, and Van was attracted to this, and so Van and Connie suggested Dave Green as the first member of the Enzyme Institute. So Dave was attracted here, and he was set up right across the railroad tracks.
Did you
here.
Know him
Dave
before
Green?
He came?
Yeah, you see, when I was when my postdoctoral year was spent in New York, and although my main laboratory was Urey's lab down in chemistry, I'd spent almost the whole spring up with Rittenberg and Schoenheimer at College of Physicians and Surgeons, the med school of Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
And up there, I'd gotten to know all the guys, Schoenheimer and Rittenberg and Schemann, who later was the chief of the NIH, and Dave Green. And actually, I got to know Paul Stumpf at that time. Incidentally, Paul's son, Dave, took his PhD in my lab a couple of 3 years ago. And Green and then Chargaff was there. Chargaff is one of the real characters in the DNA RNA story, nucleic acid story.
Mm.
You see, it was his basic observations that were the key to Watson and Crick's matching the pairs in the DNA. And Chargaff has always felt he was the forgotten man in this. But he did the pioneering work, but he didn't put the structure together.
Yeah.
But he was a fellow who established that AT and GC match up in nucleic acids, that they were always equivalent, A to T and G to C. So I used to eat lunch with Chargaff and with other members of the group there. So I got to know those.
Did you know Green
well. Yeah, I knew
quite
Green.
Well?
Well, reasonably well.
What'd you think of him?
Well, he's a very innovative guy. He's been a very productive guy from way back. You know, Green has been in on a lot of things. Green has his detractors, many detractors. But Green innovated a lot of different things. And He's a controversial person, and as a result, people don't give him as much credit as he should get.
So you would give him more credit?
Well, I give Dave a lot of credit. Mm. You know, he did a lot of innovative things.
Mm.
He did some interesting stuff back at Cambridge. He was one of the first persons to work on hydrogen metabolism there. He's one of the first people to break up bacteria successfully and study cell-free enzymes from the bacteria. The old Booth Green Mill and this sort of thing. Mm. People forget about these contributions. He was one of the first people to work successfully with isolated mitochondria to demonstrate the important metabolic reactions in the mitochondria. And certain things he pushed a little harder than he should, that sort of thing, but because he's because he can be a little prickly in some of these things, I think people tend to give him less credit than he really deserves. Well, he did a lot of innovative things.
Did you know about the cyclophorase period?
Oh, sure. That was while he was here. Yeah.
Well, he'd started on it before he came.
Yeah, sure.
Did you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's... Other people pick it up, they stick a different name on it, they give it a little twist. 15 years later, they find there is an error in it or some such thing. But he pioneered these things.
Mm.
I mean, nobody's perfect. And to try to say, well, now I've done something and some guy back in 1940 didn't do it quite as thoroughly is really not very fair, because I felt it didn't have the tools that you have to do it today. It was a different ball game, and so he was the innovator on a number of things, and he got other people working on it, and the thing finally gets shaken down. After all, we all have working hypotheses, and they aren't perfect to start with, and they develop with time. The guys who have the original ideas ought to get some of the credit.
So, from your point of view, he wasn't a disaster as an appointment.
Absolutely not. You know, he originated a lot of ideas, and people eventually cleaned them up and got them all straight.
Mm.
And there were some errors, but everybody makes errors. Science develops by in stages, and it's very dependent upon the instrumentation of the moment. And with time, it gets refined. There are mighty few established theories that haven't had errors back in the past somewhere. And it takes time to get them all perfected. But I think you got to give the originators of the idea a lot of credit. And Green did originate a lot of these things. Well, subsequently to Green, I don't know, I guess maybe Henry Lardy was the next appointee over there.
Yes, he was.
And there was some discussion at that time about whether they should go externally to get somebody, and a number of people considered. My name was mentioned. I was active in enzymology at that time. Oh. I wasn't particularly interested because I really sort of like to teach too, and I liked the biochemistry department, the contacts here, and I thought I'd be just as happy here. So it was never pushed. I don't mean to imply I was a major candidate, but it was a number of names were mentioned at that time. And Henry went out there, and Henry, of course, has been very successful. He's a first-rate biochemist, and he's done a lot of good stuff. He's made fewer mistakes than Green. But probably, I think most people would say that.
Mm.
He's been a very productive biochemist, and he's done a very good job. And also, he has trained a lot of biochemistry students. Now, Dave Green is the only member out there in recent years who was not a joint appointee elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Lardy was joint with biochemistry, and Weinert, and Nomura. So a number of people have been joint appointees with biochemistry, so they've had close ties with the people out there. So then it developed, and other people were added, like Weinert and...
Well, Corano was there.
Yeah, and there was a fellow that came over from chemistry and did a lot of electrophoresis. I can't even remember his name. He never had a substantial sized group over there. So he was one of the members. And since there were some tendencies toward personality clashes, it was always organized in terms of groups.
Mm-hmm.
Lardy's group and Amura's group and Green's group and Beiner's group were all independent
mm-hmm.
branches of the Ensign Institute. So although they got together for policy decisions, and policy decisions really came from a committee from the grad school, nevertheless it was they were pretty much independent.
Yeah, that's just the garbage, isn't it?
Yeah.
What you said about at the end about Dave Green and George Webster, well,
should I make a quick summary?
Well, yes, would you?
No. Well, in terms of Dave Green's contributions here, they were really undercut by the incident with George Webster, and in my opinion, Dave never really fully recovered from this. It was really a devastating blow because George clearly had faked the data. He had done some work on synthesis of a cytochrome, and the spectra were beautiful, and it was published in PNAS and given a fair amount of prominence, and it turned out that George had faked it, which was very difficult to understand because George Webster was a very competent person. During the year that George was here at the Ensign Institute, his wife worked in my laboratory trying to repeat some of George's earlier work on protein synthesis by P. mitochondria. And she never could repeat the work. We tried lots of different varieties of peas, thinking it might be a varietal difference and that sort of thing, but she couldn't make it work. And we never really knew whether George had faked the data on that also, or the more likely thing seemed to be that he probably had held the mitochondria long enough so that he had bacterial contamination and the bacteria were synthesizing the protein rather than the mitochondria. In any case, his wife could never make it work in our laboratory. So when it became clear that George had faked the data on the paper that he and Green had published, Dave had to retract the information publicly at the Federation meetings, and it was a sore blow to him, and I don't think he really ever recovered his zip after that. Before that, he'd been in the thick of every fight. But after that, he really quieted down and seemed to lose a lot of his zip. But in the overall picture, over the years, my feeling is Dave Green contributed a lot of ideas.
Yeah, yes.
And they were eventually developed into proper theories, and so I think he should be given credit.
Did the Ensign Institute meet the expectation that it would serve as a center for enzyme work in campus and that people, other departments, would work with people at the Ensign Institute?
Yes, I think there were. It became a rather prestigious center of enzymology, and a lot of people now who are prominent in the field actually had periods of training at the Ensign Institute.
But here on campus.
And on campus, well, in biochemistry, maybe we interacted more with them than most because a number of the staff members were joint members in the Ensign Institute. So we had active interaction with them. And it sort of set the tone and made this an Ensign Center. It wasn't just the Ensign Institute, but there were a lot of people in McArdle, biochemistry, bacteriology, who were active in the enzymology field. So Wisconsin was very prominent in enzymology, and the centerpiece was probably the Ensign Institute.
Well, that certainly is quite a different version from what Van Potter has said. I mean, he felt that it didn't meet what he had hoped for. Mm-hmm. It didn't measure up to what he had hoped it would be.
Well, maybe a difference in expectations. Maybe Van is more sanguine about these things than I am, but I thought it was effective, and it may be because in biochemistry we had a lot of interactions. Mm. I did some work with Henry Lardy and with Helmut Beinert and with some other people over there who were postdocs and such. So we had a good bit of interaction. Van in the McArdle lab maybe had a good deal less action because they were no joint members with McArdle.
Actually, he said from the McArdle point of view that they had a critical mass among themselves and didn't need to. Sure. But he was thinking of in terms of other departments than McArdle and medical school departments and other.
Well, I don't know. It's sometimes a little hard to interact with a medical school. That's probably the most difficult group to interact with. We never had any difficulty interacting with the Ensign Institute from biochemistry.
Did you do anything with Green yourself?
I never really, I don't recall ever working directly with Green, but we used to frequently discuss issues, a specific issue that had anything to do with plants. David call up and discuss it, that sort of thing.
You did.
So we used to talk about issues. Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, we did. There was one area where we had some interaction. You see, at one point, Green was explaining the storage of energy in oxidative phosphorylation in terms of a configurational change of mitochondria. He maintained that the shape of the mitochondrion was altered when it was in an energized state, and then subsequently that this changed when the energy was transferred to generate adenosine triphosphate. Well, there's a parallel in photophosphorylation. And we discussed the possibility that this sort of thing might happen in photosynthetic phosphorylation. So June Sundquist, who was a student in my laboratory, actually isolated mitochondria and set up rapid reaction chambers in which she demonstrated actually that there was a change in the interlamellar distance with the photophosphorylation, and it happened to be in the opposite direction of the mitochondria, but there was a definite change which you could show by electron microscopy. And subsequently this has not been a theory that has necessarily held water in oxidative or photophosphorylation, but it was an idea which was suggested by Green. Now the fact that he wasn't right on this should not be held against him. Frankly, every biochemist who's ever dabbled with it has come up with a theory of oxidative or photophosphorylation, all of which have been wrong. Mm. And I would not put a lot of money on the current ones, which are accepted and which have been awarded a Nobel Prize, that they still know much about oxidative
Mitchell,
or photophosphorylation.
Yeah.
The Mitchell hypothesis. I wouldn't put a lot of money that the Mitchell hypothesis is correct. It's another example of these things that develop with time.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think there's any question that you can show a configurational change in mitochondria and in chloroplasts accompanying oxidative and photophosphorylation. But whether this has anything to do with the energy transfer is another matter. But you can see these changes. Mm. And maybe it does still have something to do with it. So that was one thing where we did sort of impinge on it, and we kept in touch with him to a certain extent on that. Photophosphorylation, because he was interested in it.
Yeah, well, Potter's judgment was obviously not of the Lardy group or other groups. It was, well, I'm sure you know his opinions of Green. Well, and he's not entirely negative either.
No, I mean, I know, I'm
so
perfectly
I just,
aware that a lot of people don't like Dave and that they don't agree with Dave, but my point is that a lot of ideas originated with Dave, and whether or not he had them exactly right, I think is beside the point. I think he should get credit for originating the ideas, and if some other people clean them up, that's great, but somebody has to think these things up, and very seldom that in science that they are come full blown and absolutely correct on the first time around. Now you were speaking about other people like Gobind Khorana. Now Gobind of course was an absolutely solid scientist.
Yeah.
I doubt that anybody's going to find much wrong with Gobind's work because he was not only a fabulous scientist, but he was really a great person, a very nice individual, and a modest type of person, but just really a fabulous scientist. And as nice a guy to deal with as you ever encounter. And again, Van Potter was very instrumental in getting Gobind. He spotted him out at British Columbia and pushed pretty hard to get Gobind, so it was important in getting Gobind also. A lot of things around here we owe to Van Potter. And I don't know how many people appreciate Van, but...
His name has cropped up from time, and so I think it, to some extent, is known, but often it will be said, for instance, I think somebody says, well, E.B. Fred started the Ensign Institute, or that's a...
It's a very rare occasion when a head administrator starts something. It usually starts somewhere in the faculty, and he gives it his blessing. Well, I was recently at the 15th anniversary of the Sea Grant, and Fred Harrington was there. And people were suggesting that Fred Harrington had dreamed it up. Fred Harrington didn't dream it up. Bob Rogotsky and some others, other people did. And Harrington happened to be president at the time. And he supported it.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think he should get credit for supporting it. But it's very rare that the top administrator originates these ideas.
Yes, of course. Yeah. No, I knew that. I just knew it must be the myth that has gotten around, that it was Fred, E.B. Fred's idea. And so Van explains exactly how it started.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether I agreed. My version agreed with Van, so I imagine it's by and large.
No, he was in more, he was talking about sharing the bedroom with Elvium at the conference in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
I see. And
he was talking about the actual moment.
I see. Mm-hmm.
No,
mm-hmm.
Otherwise I'd agree.
Now, those are the two guys I'd give credit to, is Connie and Van.
You weren't by any chance at the meeting when Rockefeller people came here, and it was held at Liz Waters, and apparently Lynx sat on the steps in red satin tights. Do you know anything about that story?
This was in relation to the Ensign Institute?
Yes, it was when they were coming to inspect it.
No, I never saw KP in satin tights. I saw him in shorts plenty of times.
Shorts.
No, he used to sit out in front in shorts and drink a can of beer in the on the front steps where he would be particularly prominent on a nice sunny day.
Mm-hmm.
Eat a sandwich and drink a can of beer, sit out there in shorts.
Yeah.
When shorts were sort of frowned on.
Yeah.
His general dress for faculty members.
Yes, it was hard on the women, I gather, in the lab. Well,
he didn't have many women in the lab, though, KP.
No, not, did he have any?
I can't remember any women students offhand.
Mm.
I don't think he was very
fair. I asked her about that.
She couldn't remember any either?
No.
Yeah, I don't remember any. So I didn't have any PhDs. Women PhDs until a long time ago. The girls all got married off at the master's level. So I never kept a PhD until Manion Cho, and she was from Hong Kong, and she was married before she started in the lab. But up to that point, I never had a PhD woman in the laboratory.
Hmm.
Had a number and took master's degrees, but then they got married off. Left.
Well, you'd have to say.
Yeah. Well, Connie Elvin was chairman from 46 to 58, and then he moved into the presidency at that time, and it was obvious that although he could run biochemistry in the grad school, he couldn't run biochemistry in the university from the president's chair, so he moved out, and I became chairman of the department for some reason, which was never quite clear, but in any case, my colleagues asked me to be chairman,
I
accepted.
Did you mind taking it, or were you?
No, not particularly. I wasn't looking for administrative work. I'm perfectly happy in the laboratory, but your colleagues ask you to do it, while you're swayed by it. I was not ambitious to become chairman, but then on the other hand, I was not unwilling to do it if they wanted me to do it. So I was chairman from 58 to 70, and during that period we added a number of members to the biochemistry staff, and I don't think it was an era of great expansion in our unusual achievements in biochemistry, but we kept it was a good show. And I managed to maintain a research group too. Usually spent at least the mornings in the front office, departmental affairs, and afternoons in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. If one has any intention to continue lab work after an administrative duty, you jolly well better keep up with it or you'll be completely out of it,
yeah.
Because it's research is not something you can give up for a period of 5 years and then come back and pick it up. It moves too rapidly these mm-hmm. days. So you have to keep some activity. So we try to keep an active show going at that time. The biochem staff operations were not too onerous. There's certain compensations from being a chairman. They're quite different from the compensations of being a staff member in research. How about you, the chief compensation is you are privy to what's going on the campus. And you know what's going on in the College of Agriculture and the grad school and the university as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also quite aware of what's going on in the department. I knew much more what was going on then than I do now. At that time, I could sit down and tell some visitor exactly what every staff member was doing, and I knew most all the graduate students and all this sort of thing. So these are compensations. It's interesting. Mm. One thing that sort of gets you is that being a chairman, you are fair game for lots of committee assignments in addition. They sort of pick on the chairman to be members of administrative committees and mm-hmm. all that sort of thing, which, again, the compensations are that they are informative, you find out about things, but it doesn't help you very much in your research program and that sort of thing. It takes a lot of time, and it's sort of fun, but it doesn't get you forward in your research program. So we had people to deal with, like still K.P. Link and Harry Steenbach, and they were not the easiest people to deal with. And of course, they always considered me as a very junior individual because I'd taken courses from both of them.
Yeah.
And it's a little hard to have respect for anybody that's that much your junior. And K.P. used to like to sort of bait me on this sort of thing. For example, when he was doing his checks on rodenticides, he sometimes did these out of his home, and he would like to get the university sign painter to make up signs, beware the dog, and this sort of thing, which are really not things the department should pay for. But, you know, he'd like to needle me and raise issues like this, very, very, very minor things,
yeah.
But just to sort of...
Did he do it with humor? Was that his style, or was it...
Oh, sure. I mean, K.P. had although he may have sometimes been nasty, he also did have a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just, we took this sort of thing.
He didn't really expect you to get...
I wasn't about to take the bait unless it was really necessary. Mm. But, these things are very minor. But by and large, things went reasonably well in the department. As I say, I don't consider that I was a great and innovative chairman or anything like that, but things went along reasonably smoothly.
Okay.